It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new package of bills in the state legislature aims to fix the shortage of affordable housing here in Wisconsin with incentives for new construction and renovation. We get more of the details from one of the lawmakers who co-sponsored those bills. Now, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Think about great flavor combinations, things that go together naturally. Some standbys might leap to mind of peanut butter and jelly, pork and beans. But our next guest will take us on a much wider journey of flavor combos. How about maple syrup and fennel or sesame and chocolate? We'll get some recommendations for new imaginative pairings to try, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are some of the best but maybe also unusual food pairings you've come across or come up with yourself? What's a food or flavor you can't stand by itself, but partner it up with just the right thing? You can't get enough of it. What makes a great flavor pairing in your opinion? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Nikki Segnet is the author of Lateral Cooking and The Flavor Thesaurus. Her latest book, just out this week, is called The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. Nikki, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Now, for people who aren't familiar with the premise of your original Flavor Thesaurus book, this is not your standard issue cookbook with recipes that we have to follow to the letter. What is it that you're setting out to do with your Flavor Thesaurus of combos?
Well, what I wanted to do was make a book about why flavors work together and to give a kind of a broad range of ideas of what we might try. So a lot of the book is it's classic combinations, but there's also lots of kind of interesting things or things that are borrowed from other cultures. And it all comes together in, I think both books have about just under 1,000 pairings each. And the back will give you a quick reference list. So if you've got something in your fridge that you want to use up, you can just have a look at that. And it gives you a list of things. But then each one has a page reference and you can turn to the front and you'll get an elaboration on that pairing. It might tell you something interesting. It might give you a recipe. It might just give you some slightly off the wall tidbit of information.
One of the things you're hoping to accomplish, apart from inspiring us to try cool flavor combinations, is cut back on food waste. So if we've got a little bit of ingredient X that we had left over from that one recipe, we could look it up in the book and see what things go with it and throw something together. Is that kind of how you cook at home?
I mean, it completely is, or it's a lot more how I wanted to cook when I set out to write the first one, because it was just happening to me all the time, because all the cooking that I was doing was led by recipes in recipe books. I didn't know how to kind of freestyle. So I wanted to kind of teach myself, but also in teaching myself, help other people understand kind of what they might do with half a packet of French beans or, you know, some lentils that are sitting in the back of the cupboard. And I don't know about in where you are, but here in the UK, food prices have gone crazy. And it's just more useful than ever not to throw anything away.
In this new book now, you're focusing more on plant-led pairings. You say, is that a vegan book? Not even necessarily intended to be a vegetarian book, but what led you to want to tackle the plant world of flavors in particular?
Well, simply that when I wrote the first book and it was quite a hit straight away, it sort of started to sell a lot of copies. And I was doing events and people were coming up to me and saying, oh, I wish you'd included zucchini. I wish you'd included this. I wish you'd done lentils. And just about everything that people wanted me to write about, they'd be plants. There were lots of gardeners who had gluts of things. There were people who were shopping in the market who would find, you know, there were things on offer that they wanted to use. And that was mainly plants. The only thing that I hadn't covered already, I mean, there's all the meat and fish that's in the other book. In the first book, there was only duck that I hadn't covered. And much as I like duck, it would have been kind of strange to write about 91 ingredients and one type of meat. It just wouldn't seem right. So anyway, it just seemed like a really interesting way of understanding a bit more about plants is to make it plant-led. And like you say, it's not a vegan book or a vegetarian book, but it's definitely plant-forward.
Now, you've got a recipe for us, even though, again, the book isn't mostly recipes. It's in French. I'll give it a shot. Tarte au sucre. We've got this at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, the pairing, this combination, maple syrup, I love maple syrup, and fennel. I have mixed feelings about fennel. Talk about the combination of those two flavors, please.
Well, you might, this might be an interesting one for you to try, because actually it uses quite a small amount of fennel.
Okay.
Because one of the things that is interesting to me about writing about maple syrup is, A, it has an incredible flavor, and it has so much flavor that maple syrup has its own flavor wheel. And so it makes it an interesting ingredient and quite an easy ingredient to write about. But here in the UK, maple syrup is very expensive. And so you don't want to pair it with anything that undermines the beauty of the maple syrup itself. And one of the flavors that maple syrup, particularly the darker sort, has naturally is fennel. So I made a tart, which is based on, it's Canadian French, actually, isn't it? Tarte au sucre, sugar tart. And I made it based on a very kind of old English treacle tart recipe. And it's mainly just maple syrup and breadcrumbs in a tart case, but with just a tiny bit of fennel on the top. And all it does is it picks up on the natural fennel flavor in the syrup, but it adds a tiny bit of freshness that stops all that kind of sweetness becoming too much. You know, too, you get to a point where actually the palate gets a bit tired of things that are very, very sweet. And the fennel just, it's like opening a window a little bit in a hot room.
I've got something like that. And Wisconsin, Nikki, I don't know if you know, makes the best maple syrup in the world. You can ignore the Canadians and Vermonters and things like that. I came across a drink some time ago that had maple syrup and lemon in it. Now I use that in a lot of cocktails and mocktails. And that is that doing the same kind of premise there you just mentioned, you know, having something a little tangier, a little sharper to go along with that sort of potentially cloying flavor of maple syrup?
I mean, it absolutely would. The only problem for me is we have a product here called golden syrup. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. I've never seen it for
I
sale
did
in the
in your book.
States. You heard it in the book. Yeah. I mean, I've never seen it for sale in the States, but it's a byproduct of the sugar refining process. And it's got a really nice flavor. It's got like a toffee flavor with a kind of citric note to it. And that's what we use for that kind of tart a lot of the time. But it's a quarter of the price. So when I tried maple syrup with lemon, it tasted so much like golden syrup. And it kind of slightly undermines a lot of the natural beauty of the maple syrup. I'm not saying it's not nice, but you know, if you can get golden syrup, you might be able to do the job for less of your dollars.
We're talking to Nikki Segnet on this edition of Food Friday. She's the author of the book Lateral Cooking, and she has the Flavor Thesaurus. Her new book is an expansion on the Flavor Thesaurus: more flavors, plant-led pairings, recipes, and ideas for cooks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What two flavors to you are, if I can steal from the commercials, two great tastes that taste great together? What is a favorite pairing that you like to bring together, even either within one dish or drink, or two different dishes in the same meal? Is there something that you like combined together that other people look at you and say, "What now?" Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from James on the Facebook page. Nikki, this is interesting. A vanilla ice cream. Now, you talk a lot about vanilla in the book, and sriracha, that I don't know if this is big in the UK, but you know sriracha, the hot
I
pepper
do.
sauce. You've got a vanilla and I think peppercorn combo in there. What's the idea behind combining a vanilla and something a little spicy?
Well, I mean, the thing is, the vanilla ice cream, we're so used to it as a kind of almost like a neutral background, and it's got sugar and it's got fat. So it kind of has a bit of magic to it. It tends to make things, you know, everything tastes kind of nice. I have not tried it with sriracha. That is a new one on me, but I always say never, and I will give it a go. With the vanilla and peppercorn in the book, that is often that's being paired in ways like using a vanilla fudge, and it's just using the peppercorn to give a bit of heat and a bit of kind of slight woodiness. So if you actually taste, I mean, we don't really often think about what black pepper tastes like. We just kind of grind it on and maybe kind of just kind of accept what it is. But actually, if you really taste it, it's got quite a strong pine flavor to it, a bit pine, you know, of the wood pine, and a tiny bit of fruitiness to it. So I think that added to a vanilla, it kind of takes the vanilla natural flavor and just broadens it out a bit. It's quite a natural pairing. You wouldn't necessarily know where one starts and one stops.
And now here, you know, sometimes we use vanilla as a slang for boring, right? Or bland. And if I'm reading you right, Nikki, you don't agree with that assessment. You see a lot of use and a lot of range for vanilla.
I mean, it's definitely not bland. It is. I mean, I think the reason that we use it in that way, in that kind of calling things vanilla, is just because vanilla is so ubiquitous. People like it so much. And because we associate it with the flavor of ice cream, our brain kind of brings that ice cream or cake, you know, it brings that association with it. So when we taste things that have got vanilla in them, which is a surprising number of things that you wouldn't expect to have vanilla in them, then we naturally feel warmer towards it, like it a bit more, because it's pinging something in our brain, even if that's at a subconscious level.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to author Nikki Segnet about her new book, The Flavor Thesaurus: More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about combinations of flavors? Are her pairing ideas so far giving you some inspiration? Do you cook this way? Hey, I think this is going to taste good with that, and I'm going to wing it without a recipe. And do you have a favorite combination of flavors that's your go-to for a meal or a dessert? Does it strike other people as odd until they try it? After they try it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with author Nikki Segnet on this edition of Food Friday. Her new book is called The Flavor Thesaurus: More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. She has a zillion combos, plus or minus, of flavor combinations and how they work, why they work together. You could join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Kathy is with us in Oak Creek. Kathy, hi.
Hey, Rob. So I like to put peanut butter. I like the natural kind with no sugar, and the pizza peppers, those little pepper flakes that you put in your pizza.
Uh-huh.
And I stir that in the peanut butter, and then I like to put raw onion on there. It sounds really weird, but it's really good, and especially on a bagel.
It doesn't sound weird to me, Kathy. I use peanut butter sometimes on savory kind of sandwiches myself. What first led you to try that?
I was looking for something healthier than peanut butter and jelly.
Kathy, thank you so much. Now, peanut butter, I think in your book, your new book, Nikki, makes just a guest appearance. This is the word I'm looking for. But peanut sauce and peanut butter on savory things, it shows up in a lot of cuisines around the world. Kathy's ideas are not so weird there, are they?
That's right. I mean, peanut is in the first book, so that one covers a whole load of things that aren't necessary in the new one. I think that when I was writing the first Flavor Thesaurus, there was this thing going around where people used to say bacon goes with everything. And that might be true to the people who eat bacon, but there's a lot of people who don't eat bacon. And the thing that really does seem to go with everything is peanuts and peanut butter. I mean, you will see it in just all sorts of guises. And when I do things like this and phone-ins, it's nearly always peanut butter that comes up as something that people like to have with something that sounds quite unusual. So obviously there's peanut butter with like burger pickles, dill pickles. I don't know what you call them there. Peanut butter with mint leaves.
Interesting. And yeah, Kathy had peanut butter and onions, which I had thought of. Peanut butter with lime mixed in can make a great sauce. What is it about peanut butter? Why is it so versatile?
Well, I think the thing is that peanuts, particularly, you know, if you've got some that you're going to add a little bit of salt, they've got, again, they're salty, they're fatty, they've got a lot of flavor, because we're talking about peanuts that have been roasted. We're not talking about the raw sort. And the roasting process brings up loads of flavor in them. So it makes them kind of, it gives them, if you'll forgive me, it gives them a slight meatiness, it gives them richness, it gives them roasted flavors and stuff, all things that we find as just, you know, as human animals, very, very tasty indeed. And I think, you know, there is that idea as well that when something is very tasty and also feels quite healthy to us, it makes it taste even better.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kathy. Nancy joins us now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I'd like to tell you that I drink a lot of chocolate whey protein powder or chocolate plant protein powder. And quite often I mix it with some milk. But I do find that when I mix it with apple juice, it is just wonderful. That you have the full, rich chocolate flavor, but you have the tang of the apple. It is just a marvelous drink. And you're getting this protein without having to cook something.
Nancy, thanks a lot for that call. So, of course, chocolate and milk, I think we think of as a common pairing. What about that chocolate and, in this case, apple juice or apples, Nikki? Is that a combo you've looked at?
It is a combo I've looked at because we have a really famous chocolate here that people buy at Christmas called a chocolate orange, and it's the shape of an orange and it falls into segments. And before there was the chocolate orange, there was the chocolate apple. Now the difference was that the chocolate apple wasn't flavored apple; it was just the shape. The thing is with chocolate is it's going to, as a rule, it's going to really flatten out an apple's flavor because apple, you know, you're not going to get it won't peek through the chocolate flavor so much. So what I think you're getting is you're getting a kind of, if you like, generic fruity tang that comes through that might be nice, might lighten up the chocolate some, but you're not necessarily going to be able to tell, you know, it's not like the kind of combination where you'd be able to tell what kind of apple it was, whether it was a red apple or whether it was a very tangy apple. You just get, you just get sort of fruitiness, really.
Nancy, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Nikki Segnet about her new book, The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. Nikki, a very timely thing. People are planting their gardens here in Wisconsin, as I did. And in about 2-3 months, the most common online search term will be zucchini recipe or what to do with zucchini or how to safely dispose of zucchini. You've got a section on zucchini in the new book. What goes with the flavor of zucchini / is there a flavor of zucchini?
Well, there is, but there is the flavor of zucchini, and most of the good part of the zucchini flavor is in the skin, which is why, gardeners are really the lucky people because they can pick those zucchini when they're still really small and the skin to flesh ratio is really high. And it's lovely when you can get a bit of a char on it, whether you're griddling it or grilling it. Something it takes very kindly to that, and actually the texture is very nice too. The thing is with the inside, like all squash, really, it's got those seeds, and they can become quite rustic tasting, in not necessarily the nicest possible way. So you know, if they get big, they start to taste a bit like rainwater that you might have collected in your in your water butt. And it's quite subtle. So, of course, I think one of the obvious ways, one of the ways that you might learn to cook zucchini if you do garden is to make the Marcella Hazam zucchini fries with garlic, because obviously the garlic kind of takes away any of that slight rustic taste. But zucchini fries, I mean, I'm not terribly sure anyone could ever get bored of them. But if you do, the thing to do is probably go to the cheesemonger. And, you know, courgettes and cheese, there's so many different ways that you can cook them together. But my favorite, and I do like to practice my souffle skills, but courgette and cheese makes a really great souffle.
What are some cheeses that taste, do you think, particularly good with zucchini? Because we also have, in addition to maple syrup, some cheese here in Wisconsin.
Sorry, what's that?
What kind of cheeses pair well with zucchini?
Well, obviously, Wisconsin cheeses pair really well. I think I've been to Wisconsin, and I believe people wear cheese on their heads.
They do.
Often we would be making something like a souffle, then you're going to want something that's like a Gruyere, maybe teased up a bit with some Parmesan, but you can definitely use cheddar in the same place. But Gruyere would be the absolute ideal in that case. But you may know of a famous Greek dish called spanakopita, which is a mixture of spinach and feta in phyllo pastry. Well, courgettes can stand in for the spinach. So it's a lovely kind of mixture of sliced courgettes and crumbled feta with lots of buttery phyllo. It makes a beautiful pie. A really great meal, a really great supper with a glass of wine. You could make them into courgette fritters, but use chickpea flour instead of like ordinary plain flour. And that way you get kind of quite a, um, get a slightly rougher texture, but you also get a slightly sulfurous taste. It's a very pleasant taste with vegetables. I don't know what you call it there. We call it besan here sometimes, which is like the Indian name for it.
I want to get into one more combo that's in your book, and we'll stay with the cheese theme here. Cheese goes well with raisins, you say. Could you talk about using raisins and cheese together as a combo?
Well, I don't know if you do, given that you have quite a strong cheese culture, but here we really like to pair cheese, hard, tangy cheeses, with all sorts of fruitcakes. So I don't know if the culture of regifting fruitcake is quite the same in the States, but people don't tend to get very excited about a fruitcake
right,
at Christmas
here.
Like they used to. But keep it, cut it into slices and eat it with cheese. It's an old tradition in the north of England, and it's absolutely fantastic. Probably because if you think about a lot of the flavors that you get in raisins and in dried fruit are very similar to the flavors that you'll find in something like a Shiraz, a Syrah, a Cote de Rhone, that kind of wine. So you get all those lovely vinous, rich, deep flavors and tannins as well in the dried fruit that work really well with the cheese because they soften up the cheese and the cheese softens up the fruit and they just have that lovely kind of reciprocal agreement.
Fantastic. Nikki, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. And I will be trying chocolate and apple juice.
Excellent. That's Nikki Segnet, author of Lateral Cooking and the Flavor Thesaurus. We've been talking about her latest book. It's called The Flavor Thesaurus, More Flavors, Plant-Led Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for Cooks. You can keep sharing your favorite combos on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Jacqueline there, who says cinnamon rolls with chili. Ooh, I've seen that. And we heard from Greg in Duluth, who says chili powder, not store-bought, and some homemade applesauce. Lots of people have their own cool combinations. Keep sharing yours on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, explore the frontiers of prosthetics and limb replacement and some of the latest medical advances in those fields. And you could share, if you have a story to share in your own life of someone who's received a prosthetic, how have things changed over the years? You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the World News Roundup with updates on Russia and Ukraine, a ban on some short-distance air travel in France, and more. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, chances are, if you've been looking for affordable housing in Wisconsin lately, you haven't had as many options as you might like. The state needs more than 100,000 additional housing units to catch up with current demand and to meet the needs of the next decade. That's according to a report from Forward Analytics, the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association. The groups behind a new package of bills in the state legislature hope they can address at least some of the supply side of the housing issue. State Senator Romaine Quinn is a Republican representing Senate District 25 in northern Wisconsin. It includes Rice Lake, Spooner, Park Falls, and Phillips. He's a co-sponsor of this package of four bills. I talked to him yesterday afternoon. Well, I think a lot of people have encountered the problem of high-cost housing. We've talked about a lot on the show. Can you tell us what you're seeing as the scope of the problem we're trying to solve here?
Well, frankly, we're in a housing crisis right now, and it doesn't matter what income level you are or where you live in the state. There is a critical shortage and a critical need into every corner. So it's a good thing and a bad thing. It's a bad thing. It's this big of a problem, but it's a good thing because it finally has the attention of the entire legislature because no one is immune from the shortage of housing today.
Before we get into the particulars of the bills you're looking at, let's talk about the process a little bit and who you've had at the table. That's an interesting part of the story, I think.
Yeah, everybody. So I just want to give a shout out to Representative Rob Brooks. He really initially spearheaded this, and he brought everyone to the table. So the Builders Association, the Realtors Association, the League of Municipality, Towns Association, counties, anyone that would have a stake or an impact in the development of housing. And so I'm pretty excited because we have had everyone at the table. I think we're really almost 99% there, just have a few technical tweaks left. But these bills are ready to roll.
All right, let's dig into some of the particulars in the bills here. Let's start with this idea of right zoning or truth in zoning aimed at helping local governments get projects approved and off the ground.
So developers need certainty. That's a huge component of this. They have to know that when they find a plot of land in a particular area that's zoned a particular way, when they develop a project, they have to know it's going to be approved in a timely manner, because our construction season is very short in northern Wisconsin. And if it's not here, they'll build somewhere else. So what we want to do is say, hey, communities, go back and look through your ordinances, through your master plans, through your zoning requirements. And is this really where you want to be? Or could there be more flexibility? Because once these are set, you have to approve projects that fit your criteria. So communities would be no longer be allowed to move the ball on developers when a project is trying to come in. We've seen this in a few communities where some neighbors come and complain to their council members or planning commission, and pretty soon the project keeps changing and keeps getting whittled down. And instead of 90 units, it's 60 units. And all of a sudden, it's cost prohibitive. It just doesn't pencil out. So we just want to say, whatever rules you have, you choose. The state's not telling you. But then you have to actually follow them and approve projects in a timely manner that fit them.
Now, I could see maybe somebody listening saying, hey, wait a minute, that was me. I lived in a neighborhood. I saw a development that I think would have negatively affected traffic or what have you. And they might worry, is this taking away my ability to go to my representatives and have a say in what goes on in my neighborhood?
Nope, you absolutely can still do that. But what you would want to do is talk to your council member or your representatives to say, hey, what is our master plan today? Where does my house fit in that? And do I like what's on the books? So it's really going to require them to go through and do a final review process to say, hey, knowing that we have to actually approve projects based on our current regulations, what are our current regulations? And are they what we want to see today and tomorrow? And we'll fix those. So this bill does give them time. It's a year before implementation, and that's why even the League of Municipalities is neutral on the bill. They're not opposing it because we're not necessarily telling you what to do. We're just saying, hey, get your house in order and follow your own rules once they're established.
Another bill aims to provide loans for a Main Street housing rehabilitation, in some cases using those second and third floors, I think, of a downtown building. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, I don't think there is a Main Street anywhere in any little community in Wisconsin that does not have spaces that are unused above their downtown businesses. So we want to incentivize and help developers or those business owners to say, hey, look up. And those apartment spaces that are used for storage or were just abandoned, can we refurbish those and create some downtown housing, which, again, fixes our housing problem, but also helps to revitalize those businesses in downtown areas that we're always struggling to do. So it's a win-win there, I think, for people looking for housing and for the businesses in our downtown areas.
Now, if I'm a developer, I could say, okay, I can go on the outskirts of town and do, 20, 30 units, or I can do what? One or two units at a time. How are you hoping the structure of these loans will incentivize a developer to pay attention to that kind of project?
Yeah, and that's part of the problem is they're never going to come into a downtown and do that unless they have the cheap or free capital. So these are 0% loans that would go towards these projects. And so it helps to sweeten the pot in the bottom line just a little bit, where maybe they would take a second look.
Talking to State Senator Romaine Quinn about a series of bills aimed at tackling the high cost of housing in communities around the state. Another bill on the list, Senator, is what people have called the Shopko bill. Now, my Shopko I used to go to, I understand, is being used as a rental storage facility. This bill is aimed at getting vacant commercial properties converted. It's a tall order, in some cases easier said than done, into residential. What does this one do?
Exactly what you just said. We want to take some of these abandoned, blighted, or underutilized properties that probably have a pretty good location based upon the existing business or what business was there, and reconvert those into housing. So we would, again, give you a 0% loan to either demolish, take those down, and build back into residential housing, or if you can actually refurbish them and make them fit for housing opportunities. We want to help developers do that as well.
And then finally, there is another loan program. Now, I've had friends buy an older building, and wow, it's a good thing they know what they're doing. It's a tall order, takes a lot of work and renovation. Another piece of legislation targets some of those older residential buildings. What does this one do?
Yeah, as we are looking at expanding housing opportunities, we got to stop the bleed. We got to stop losing the housing stock we already have today. So if I can help you with a zero interest loan to put that roof on, to put that siding on, or change those windows out and keep your property from deteriorating to the point of no return, let's do that. And then there's, again, 0% You have the ability to pay that back over time or with the sale of your home, trying to make sure that we're keeping the stock we already have. Wisconsin historically has quite a bit older housing stock compared to other states, and especially in my district, like the city of Superior, has some of the oldest housing stock in the entire state. So we just want to make sure as we're expanding opportunities, we got to be able to keep what we have as well.
Now, a lot of these involve loans, 0% loans, which sounds pretty good given that interest rates have gone up lately. Can you talk about that approach of a loan as opposed to, say, tax credits or direct investment or other fiscal options?
Well, I think it's hard when we start talking about grants, right? You know, what businesses, who are they? Because this is taxpayer dollars, and we have to be fiscally responsible with that. So by having a 0% loan, we're giving you the capital you need to get these projects off the ground, but it will come back to us in a revolving loan fund, and that's the best part. So let's say I'm a community and I need $1 million or $2 million to retrofit an old Shopko building downtown. Well, when I pay that back, that goes back into the pool, and it's going to fund the next project in the next community with someone doing the same thing. So we have a lot of one-time money in this budget. I can't think of anything better than setting some aside in a revolving fund that will continue to make gains on the issue of housing that we have.
As we wrap up, Senator Quinn, what's the timeline on this package of legislation?
Well, I had a hearing on them all in my committee last week. We are working on some real technical minor changes. There's a few amendments being jockeyed around, but we're very, very close. So I'm hoping to exec these out of the Senate committee by next week.
Senator Quinn, thanks again for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was State Senator Romaine Quinn, Republican representing Senate District 25 in northern Wisconsin. I talked to him yesterday about a package of affordable housing bills he's co-sponsoring in the legislature. Coming up, we're going to hear some responses to these bills from the president of the Wisconsin Council for Affordable and Rural Housing, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What does the supply of affordable housing look like where you live in Wisconsin? Do you work in one place and have to live fairly far away because that's the closest you can afford? Is the market you want to buy a house or rent an apartment in Wisconsin or beyond affordable for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about a new set of legislative proposals to address the shortage of affordable housing in Wisconsin. Russell Caney is with us now, president and co-founder of the Wisconsin Council for Affordable and Rural Housing. Russell, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for the invite.
Can you tell us, first of all, a little bit about your organization and what it does?
Sure. The Wisconsin Council for Affordable Rural Housing was established in 1997 by a group of developers and property managers and others that really saw a need for education, advocacy, and collaboration with other funders across the state of Wisconsin in affordable housing, but with a real emphasis on the rural parts of the state.
I think sometimes when people think of affordable housing problems, they might think in a, you know, a growing city, an urban environment. Can you talk about some of the challenges in rural and smaller town Wisconsin?
Sure. Across Wisconsin, as we know, there's some real economic drivers in the state, Madison, Milwaukee, kind of the triangle down to Beloit, and really growth areas. But when we get to a lot of the smaller communities, particularly the ones that we hear from and where we have a number of people that are in our organization, they have different circumstances. They may have an opportunity to recruit a business, recruit teachers, others to their community, but the housing many times is a barrier to get people into those communities. Not only just the inventory of housing that might be available, both rental and home ownership, but then just what the cost is for that particular housing. So we see that all over the state.
Senator Quinn used the word crisis there. Do you think that's overstating it, or is there a crisis, at least in some communities?
No, I think crisis is a good word. There's nothing like a crisis. I think what he's done, and I applaud him for his efforts, what he's done is elevate the conversation so that it's including all parts of the state. And I particularly like his position from the standpoint of speaking from northern Wisconsin, where a lot of housing issues have just not been addressed.
Let's get your thoughts on a couple of the proposals we heard from the senator. First, the bill to revitalize main streets in Wisconsin with incentives for developers to work on those units, as we heard, above those downtown storefronts.
Yeah, that is a program that I think would work very well under the right legislation and put together the right way. Wisconsin has always had a very supportive and strong Main Street program, which was developed by the National Trust. And that has worked with a number of communities in the past. And what you do see in Wisconsin is you have a lot of federal funds for housing that come down to the state and then are distributed to different developers through Wisconsin agencies that basically administer those funds. I applaud all these bills, really, because they're really generating activity in the state of Wisconsin and not depending so much on the federal government and those federal funds flowing down. Now, with any of these bills, I think it's important to realize that the more that you can leverage with federal funds that are already coming into the state of Wisconsin, the better off everyone will be, because you'll be able to create more housing. The Main Street program, I can go through many of the downtown communities and look up, as he was mentioning, and seeing a lot of vacant space that could be put to good use, particularly in housing.
And another bill incentivizing rehabilitation renovation of single-family homes. How big a deal is that in rural communities?
Well, it is, because we have old housing stock in Wisconsin, and particularly when you go to some of the rural communities, you'll see homes that were many times built in the after World War II, many before that. Many of them need upgrades. Energy upgrades, windows, doors, you name it. Sometimes these things are taken care of when the home is sold and someone moves in and does a rehab of the home. But many times these are longtime homeowners that need help and just those upgrades and keeping those homes in good condition for the next potential owner down the road.
Talking to Russell Caney with the Wisconsin Council for Affordable and Rural Housing, looking at a lack of affordable housing availability in many communities around the state. Some new proposals in the state legislature aimed at tackling at least parts of that problem. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, so I'm very interested in this topic, and I commend the intention behind these bills. I'm confused by the way Senator Quinn described the bill pertaining to homeowners getting a loan to rehab. He gave the example of a roof on an old house, for instance. He was talking about those homeowners being able to get a zero interest rate loan in the same way that these bills provide for developers. But in the copy of that bill that I was able to get, it actually explicitly changes the law to prohibit homeowners from receiving a zero interest rate loan from WIDA, and instead takes away that ability and requires that there be an interest rate charged to homeowners, while simultaneously requiring that these loans be offered at a zero interest rate to developers. I suppose it's possible that the text of the bill that I was able to get from the LRB, you know, has been changed while this is in negotiations. But that's something I really hope that Senator Quinn could clear up, because the text of the bill I've been able to find contradicts what he just told you.
John, thanks for the call. Russell, this is a moving target. Do you know how that is shaken out so far, that specific detail on 0% interest loans for that homeowner during renovations we were talking about?
Yeah, I do not. But I would say that, you know, there's need for both. I think from current homeowners that need to do the repairs and do the rehab and just don't have the funding, that would be helpful. I can also see where there's a lot of abandoned homes or homes that have gone through foreclosure that may be picked up by a developer or a builder. And to incentivize them to come in and do a good rehab, not just patch things together and then just rent it out in a condition that's really not appropriate for good living space. I can see where that would be a good incentive for developers, builders, particularly ones that are emphasizing or are really into the rehab business.
John, thanks for calling in and pointing that out. Russell, you were just out visiting, I understand, some apartment renovation projects yesterday in Grant County. Can you tell us some of what you saw and how it fits into our conversation?
Yeah, the our organization had as a developer and management company that took on and bought from a nonprofit a 39-unit development that was for originally built back in the 1970s for seniors. This was in Cuba City, Wisconsin, a small community of 2,100 people. And there's no other dedicated senior housing in that particular community. So this property was, frankly, just tired. It needed a lot of work, a lot of rehab. It was still occupied, people still living there. But along with some ARPA funds and some affordable housing program funds from the Federal Home Loan Bank, tax credits from WIDA, patching together other bits and pieces of funding, there was a complete rehab of the 39 units. So they had a reopening yesterday with community folks there, gave a tour of some of the units. So it was really nice to see a property that has been rehabbed and will be in good shape now going into 2024 and beyond for seniors in that community.
That's interesting, Russell, because I think a lot of times about this housing issue as, you know, workforce housing, workers being able to afford to live in or near the place they work. Can you talk about seniors and how communities are dealing with that for people who want to retire and stay in the community they've lived in and age in place as much as they can in the community they've been living in?
You know, aging in place is important. If they can stay in their home, particularly as they get older and start having some physical disabilities and such, there's all kinds of rehab that can be done to older homes to attempt to keep folks and seniors in their homes, whether it be ramps or doing some modifications to the bathrooms and such. The other important part is just to have some other alternatives available in that particular community, whether it be assisted living, whether it be apartments that are appropriate for seniors, again, with maybe no-step type one-floor access to units. A lot of the seniors want to stay in their communities as they get older. They don't want to have to make a choice of moving away to get good housing and then leave their friends, their churches, their communities behind. So it's important, and we have a senior population that's large in Wisconsin and really is a backbone of a lot of these communities.
Russell, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Russell Caney, president and co-founder of the Wisconsin Council for Affordable and Rural Housing. He joined us for a look at efforts to build more affordable housing units around the state with four new bills on the issue in the state legislature. Just a little while ago, we heard from State Senator Romaine Quinn, co-sponsor of that legislation, talking about what it would do, the impact it might have. Now, we want to hear from you. You can share your story if you've been on a quest to find housing, rental or buying something. Tell us about it. Did it go easily? Were you able to find something you could afford? Are you still looking? Are you having to get something that's really technically out of your price range to live where you want or need to live? Let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or is there a piece of this story you want to hear more about? It's something we could tackle in a future conversation or pass along to our news team. Again, email ideas@WPR.org with your experiences or your questions. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, for a lot of people, we have our calendar age and a mental age where we might think of ourselves as, in many cases, younger than we actually are. Find out why our self-image doesn't always match the number of candles on that birthday cake. And the author of the new book, The Power of Language, tells us why learning a second or third language can have huge benefits at any age, not just in terms of, you know, being able to talk to more people, but benefits for our brains, our mental and emotional well-being, too. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.